Hello and welcome to the Research VR Podcast, episode number 13, where we dig deep into research of virtual reality through the lenses of cognitive science. I'm your host, Oz Balabanian, and joining me today is Mr. Peter Lekoff and Christoph Izdebski.
Hi.
Good evening.
For those of you joining us for the first time, we specialize in explaining complex scientific papers and principles about your brain and how they apply into virtual reality. In today's episode, we're digging into how VR affects memories and dreams. It's a pretty cool one, guys. I think a lot of people have been asking in terms of, and really yearning to know how their memory and behavior gets changed by being in VR. And I think we have a couple of thoughts to share on that.
Definitely. And I mean, if you're speaking about memory, right, one could ask yourself, you know, why would we even report on memory? I mean, VR is all about moving and you have a lot of sensors that are creating your multimodal experience as well. In fact, VR, at least in theory, and you will learn more about it during this episode, should have an enormous influence on your memory. And not only is VR supposed to improve it, but, and this is mostly interesting for the serious game developers and researchers out there, the ecological validity of your simulations is increased in VR, and that means also that the memory itself can be manipulated or being, you know, more stronger influenced by it, right? Due to the stronger simulation, the dreams and other memory consolidation effects are also achieved. So whether you're building a serious game for, you know, vocabulary training, or you're doing science which involves VR, you not only should be aware of the effects of the memory influenced by VR, but maybe also use them to your advantage.
Absolutely. I think let's lay down the groundwork in terms of the terminologies and things that people need to know for memory. So what is memory? Actually, I think my professor put it best in college, Professor Benjamin Storm. He says that it's the way to reconstruct the past, and it's the influence of previous experiences on our future thought and behavior. Because memory isn't just backward-facing. Memory is all about how your future self will be behaving, and future self in the next 5 seconds, the next, you know, year. And so without it, you wouldn't be able to learn or adapt. So memory can be split into three separate sections: encoding, storage, and retrieval. Encoding is the act of storing the information. Chris, tell us a little bit about the biases and the different limitations that we have in terms of encoding our memories.
From my perspective and a bit of research I've done on this topic, encoding seems to be one of the most strongly influenced parts of memory by virtual reality. That's because, first of all, we have a subjective bias when we are encoding information. And that is because we are perceiving the world through our own eyes, from our own egocentric perspective. That means that every single event that we will remember will be at least in part remembered from the first person perspective. And from what I've seen in virtual reality games and content, the coolest content is the one that happens from the first person perspective. Now, a second very important thing about virtual reality and memory is that the more senses are involved in a certain event or a certain information, the better it's going to be encoded. That means that when you were playing your Doom on a PC with the desktop, you just had a visual information, basically, and maybe audio. Now, in virtual reality, hopefully, one day, the new Doom will be done with the Vive controllers or other hand-tracking controllers, and then you will be jumping there with your own body and moving around and having not only sound, but maybe also a Tesla suit or other haptics feedback. And that means that overall, you would have far, far more sensory input for a very certain information or a certain event. And that leads us also to the next effect that is called generation effect. And this effect means that if you are interacting with information actively, you will also much more efficiently encode it. You will much more efficiently save it because you will have more information attached to it. So, for example, there is a long list of research showing that if you can at least rotate an object on the screen, on the normal screen, not even in virtual reality, with a mouse, you will remember this object much better than if this object would rotate by itself, just because you actively interacted with the information.
Right. This is the self-generation effect, as in, like, if you yourself are doing actions that are self-generated, that you are kind of moving and playing with yourself, you have much higher chance of encoding it better and then being able to retrieve it. And so another research I've seen on this is essentially for better learning, let's say for tests or whatnot, if you yourself can come up with examples for the principle that you're trying to figure out, you actually learn it much, much better, because you're generating things about it. And so your kind of brain kind of goes through, more effort into into actualizing that concept and coming up with examples. And so that's just one way of the generation effect. And another is what Chris was just describing with manipulating the object. So grabbing it, moving it left and right, just looking at it from different ways. And we were kind of discussing this earlier, saying, well, you know, if you're coming at this from an advertising perspective, how can you, you know, the question is always, how do people remember your brand better? Well, what if it's somehow of an interactive thing? Chris, you were talking about old banner ads where, you know, you have targets and you have to shoot some.
From the real life. So the idea was that when you are going through Reddit, or you were going through Reddit, I have not seen those advertisements for some time already, but sometimes there were advertisements on the websites where on the side you could shoot with a gun or a bow or something into the shields. And if you shoot down 3 shields, then you were sent to the website of this particular advertisement.
Yeah, and then you kind of are more interesting to interact with it. So, I mean, you kind of already, you know, played a small game with 3 avoiding the shield or shooting in them, and then you're kind of more interested what will actually come. But, I mean, memories also can be influenced by the way how often you see a brand, right? You can clearly see a higher activation of your brain area, which is responsible for the pleasant feeling we feel when you are drinking Coca-Cola compared to Pepsi, and you can actually measure it in the fMRI. So how often you see things, how well you interact with them, there are many features that are, you know, actually leading towards your memory consolidation.
And you know what's actually even more interesting is we always worry about subliminal messaging, right? And people in the 60s thought that they took it a little bit too far, but actually these kind of effects actually really do exist, and brand recognition or the willingness to buy a certain product, when it's a brand that you say that you will buy from, but you don't really know why, it actually is higher if you don't really recognize that you've seen that brand before or you're willing to buy it. So, I mean, brand recognizability. Product placement is huge, even if you recognize that you saw a product placement there or not. To your brain, it's all about, you know, exposure, exposure, exposure. So the more exposure you have, the more willing you will be, the more willing you'll choose that over anything else just by the mere exposure effect. Attentional blindness is pretty interesting, actually, in terms of encoding, too. Where you really, what you're attending to, what you're putting your attention on, really affects what you will be encoding about that information. One example is that if there's a gun pointed at you, you actually kind of do go into a little bit of a tunnel vision when you're kind of just concentrated on the gun. And so there's a lot of times where witnesses come out of crime situations and they don't remember a single thing about the perpetrator's face, because they were literally had this tunnel vision on the threat itself. And so that's kind of shows how attention can be really guided into a certain thing. Another way of seeing attentional blindness is called the gorilla study, where it's a pretty classic Psych 101 video you watch, where you watch a video of these people throwing, passing a basketball around to each other, and you have to count how many times the basketball is being passed around. But what you don't notice is in the middle of the video, there's a guy in a gorilla suit comes out and like bangs on his chest and he walks away, and you just don't notice that at all because your attention is so honed down exactly on counting the balls.
Which may actually sound ridiculous, but I've been caught on this effect every single time when I watch this video. I even knew that this gorilla is coming. But if I focus on the counting the balls, then I was missing the gorilla. Yeah.
And we will also link the video, obviously, in the show notes.
So the video is so popular in all these site classes that actually someone did another research on top of that where I forget what it was called, but essentially it's building another thing that's changing in the environment that you won't be able to notice. So they're counting on you to seeing the gorilla, but they don't count on you on seeing that the curtains behind them changed, I think, color. So if you change the color of something in a slow enough manner, you will not notice it, even if it's like over 30 seconds or a minute long, like literally going from like orange to blue, like something drastic like that. If you change the color slow enough, there's a lot of change blindness that you'll experience and you just won't notice that. So those are fun limitations, I think, that really show us that our perception even is nowhere near what we think it is. And that's due to our brain really filling in the gaps and giving us a coherent story for us to remember by. So the second step in memory is storage. And so after you encode these memories, how does that transfer to your long-term memory, or what gets transferred? And the way you do that actually is by sleeping. And a byproduct of sleeping is dreaming. So you're dreaming, you actually dream every single night, you know, despite the fact that sometimes you don't remember your dreams, and actually a lot of the times you won't, but even within a single night, you will have 3 to 5 dreams a night. And the reason why you don't remember all of these is because you'll remember the last, usually you'll remember the fifth dream, which is the last one right before waking up. So sleep is something that kind of people know very little about even today. It's been, I think, an interest of all of ours, but I think dreaming is, something that every single animal does, like every single insect, animal, being. And because it's every species needs to remember something about what they did that day so that, you know, it's a old evolutionary trait that we've grown into. What's interesting is that people have been reporting that after being in VR for about a week or two, they've been having some intense dreams and visuals whenever they're going to sleep. And I actually called up my professor, Dr. Storm, and I presented this to him, and he said that this actually makes complete sense. What he compared it to is that when you're learning to ski, right, the first weekend you're up in the slopes and you're going down, it takes a lot of cognitive effort for you to learn at the first hour, even more than the next couple of hours. And all of the memories that you're encoding at that time need to be organized and consolidated. And so that first night and the first couple of nights when you go to sleep, actually, your brain is trying to make a sense of what the hell you just did that day. So to do that, you start to dream about what you just did. And so either that's skiing or that's playing Tetris, you know, intensively for a couple of hours, like you will see that in your dream afterwards. And the same thing with VR. I mean, I can even report this by myself. Like I've had this experience happen to me, especially when we first got, I think, the Vive, when it was kind of very movement-based, you know, experience rather than a DK2 sitting down with a mouse and keyboard, and you actually get to jump around and move around and like you do things that you've never really done before, see things and experiences that never has happened. And so your brain really needs to start make sensing of it. So a lot of cognitive effort, I guess we could say that it leads to more dreams in terms of experiences.
And when we speak about dreams, there is actually a theory why and how the brain is working during the sleep cycles. And there is also some research that is actually being directed on trying to apply those hypothetical principles to the neuronal networks. And the idea is that during the day, you're walking around and the overall activation of your brain is rising with every minute you're running around. So later in the evening, I mean, you feel tired and you kind of saw a lot of new things and they made some impressions. And the overall level of activation in your neuronal network is kind of high. And then during the sleep, this level goes down and the consolidation is happening by actually establishing what is like really important and makes sense and actually stayed there. And then when you wake up, your neurons are, you know, fresh, recovered, and their overall activation level is kind of a little bit less active than when you actually went to sleep. There is potentially also some neuronal activity happening during sleep that is reducing the overall activity in general.
I think it is a more connected network whenever you are sleeping, like the brain. So it's less compartmentalized and working on, you know, during your daytime. So that's why things kind of get weird and blurry, and because it's your brain is like kind of into defragmentation mode, and it's just going back and just like trying to consolidate and put, you know, specific memories into specific boxes and seeing how each connect. Dreaming is actually really good for creativity. So creativity, that's a whole field of research, actually, is people trying to figure out what creativity is. And when you do sleep and dream, you start to make certain connections that you wouldn't have when you were awake. And so if you are having a writer's block, or if you are having kind of a creative need for creativity, sleeping and dreaming, especially just like even napping before going back to sleep, that kind of takes away the bounds of your brain thoughts, and you start to put together certain concepts and associations that you probably wouldn't have before.
But that happens only if you already worked a lot on a certain topic. So in a sense, when you are already overloaded even. So if you have thought about it so much that you can't move on anymore, and then you have this relaxation moment, then you may have this light bulb moment.
And I mean, there's the same effect with lucid dreams. So to anyone who doesn't know what it is, lucid dreaming is basically the idea that when you are sleeping and you have a dream, you realize that you're dreaming, but you're not waking up. You can actually train that by having a sleep diary. So a dream diary, basically you write down every dream, and then after some time you might remember them better and also recognize them while you're sleeping. And then there are some techniques to stabilize it, so you're actually not waking up. And the idea is that people who are, you know, learning a certain new sport, for example, playing tennis, can, during their lucid dreams that they induce through special techniques, like, you know, memorizing it and looking at how much fingers you have and any other cues that actually might suggest that the dream is actually right now happening and this is not real life around you. And when they perform those moves that they learned during the day in the lucid dream explicitly over and over again, you can measure that they're getting better in real life too. So you can actually kind of suggest your brain what you want to consolidate a little bit more by, you know, inducing those lucid dreams. And VR might actually have a similar effect, right? Because you can relive certain things and you can repeat them over and over again. And the brain might, you know, just think, oh, well, it looks kind of dreamy. I need to learn that. Yeah, I'm going to.
So speaking of lucid experiences, I think this leads into Jeremy Bailenson's study on children and false memories. The idea of something being false, actually, in terms of a memory is not that absurd, actually. I honestly would say that every single memory that you have is somewhat false because of the things that we just talked about in terms of encoding failures and the limitations there. And then even afterwards, when you are retrieving these memories, every time you retrieve a memory, your brain essentially has a lot of gaps to fill. And it does that by kind of generating like what seem to be plausible there. So every time you're thinking of the memory again, those gaps are filled in with kind of the narrative that you're trying to tell, something that would make some more sense to you. So, and that kind of leads to false memories, or at least parts of memories being false. But even you can even start to believe of certain memories that you have never done, but you actually believe that you have done them. If I tell you to imagine yourself sitting on an elephant at the beach, you start, you know, you can visually kind of see it in your own head. And to your brain, that's almost like actually seeing it. And if I tell you kind of to elaborate on that visual of think of the sounds that are there, think of the sensory, how does it feel to sit on that elephant and the breeze and the smells? So you start to elaborate on top of that visual and you're creating like a pretty good memory. And if you think about this over and over again, let's say a week down the line, a month down the line, that will essentially solidify that memory in your head as being some of a real memory. You know, because to your brain, it doesn't matter if it happened outside of your eyeballs or inside. To it, it's a real thing. So Jeremy Bellinson from Stanford, who's been doing a lot of research in VR, you know, for I think 20 years now, he published these results about a year or two ago. About 50% of preschool participants developed a false memory of what they saw in VR when they were questioned about it a week later. So they were in VR, they were like swimming with dolphins, with whales, and then they were asked about it immediately afterwards, and then a week after that as well. And according to the study itself, they essentially reported that they actually did swim with the dolphins and the whales. And so when I was talking to my professor again about this, he kind of didn't like this study much at all. He said that since they are preschool children, all the language is an actual issue where they might have misunderstood the question. I mean, if you ask me, you know, did you play this game, or let's say, did you jump on a wall and shoot someone? I would say yes, because you did actually do that in whatever game you're playing. And to children, that, you know, the distinction might even be a bit less. And especially with VR and they not being so used to this new technology, that probably added a bit to the effect as well. So it's an interesting thing to look at, I think, and kind of helps guide us to understand how our memory does work. And to us, these experiences are going to be more real than ever, you know, VR experiences, immersive experiences. And whether or not you can call something a false memory as because it's through VR, I don't really think so. Because in the end, it's a real thing that you're experiencing. Even if it's a dream, you know, that's still something you're experiencing. But so there might be certain languages used or attention-grabbing headlines that people like to. And finally, retrieval is the third part of memory. And that's all about having access to the memory itself. So the way retrieval works is every memory is connected to other memories. There's no memory that kind of exists by itself. And so you go down the line of memories until you reach the one that you're looking for. And so usually, typically, the way you access a memory is through something called a cue. So a cue is some, let's say I look up on the wall and I see a poster for the thing. You know, that's a very strong cue because it literally says the name of the movie itself. But sometimes it's more subtle than that. You know, it's a smell that you just kind of smell walking down a street and it triggers the memory of your ex-girlfriend. And so these cues have different weights, and different sensory cues have different weights. One really interesting thing about VR is that environment, now we have kind of full environmental control, and environments actually are really big cues in terms of memories. And what this means for design, what this means for any kind of application is that now we can actually try to tie certain memories to environments. And since we are such, let's say, animals, our spatial memory is very, it's a very good cue for us to work on.
Okay, so there are two methods for the improvement of retrieval. There are external and internal cues. So that means that for the external cues, we use context. We use what happened to us around. So, for example, there is a big castle on the horizon and we use it as a landmark. Or that it was a sunny day in this particular event. We can, and if we see in the real world a sunny day, then we might trigger this memory of the particular scene in virtual reality. And then we also have state-dependent effects, which are internal cues. And that means that if I am sad today, I have a higher chance of recalling or retrieving the sad memories. Or if I'm happy, I might remember something, some event where I was also happy. But it's not also only about emotions or moods. It's also that if I was high, so if I am high right now, I might remember the event where I was high before and recall some cool memory from that time.
I think the emotion element of it is really interesting. Think of the time where, you know, someone's pissing you off and suddenly you're kind of, or your view of the world, or even your view of yourself and your experiences are very negative. And you think, you know, like, oh, like I've been crossed so many times, like the world is not fair to me. And it's because you're starting to remember all the times that then, you know, these things have happened to you, the negative things. And when you are in a happy and blissful state, you, when you look back on your memories, you will remember the blissful things. I think on average, you do have a more positive outlook on your back, and that's called the rosy effect. And that's a pretty well established like phenomenon. But whatever state you were in, whatever mood you're in, actually really changes the way you remember the past. And so this kind of goes beyond like moods that you were saying, Chris. Now, another quick thing to point out are things like grid cells and place cells. Actually, this is pretty much on the bleeding edge of neuroscience these days, and people are still figuring out how these things work. And I think we're kind of just associating these cells. I mean, they're just essentially different types of neurons that are dedicated to processing just certain types of stimuli. So grid cells are actually spatially laid out in a hexagon, and they're almost like a one-to-one representation of the place that you're in. So if you're walking, you know, from left to right, then the grid, the neurons in the grid will fire from left to right. And place cells are kind of more of a fully, let's say more Gestaltian, holistic approach to a place. So if you walk into a room, that room, it can be associated to a certain amount of place cells. And even if you change major details about the room, you know, change, you know, furniture, change the color, those same cells will fire the next time you are in that room. And so you can kind of envision this sometimes when you walk down a random alley or a street, and suddenly you're like, whoa, I've been here before. And you actually don't know why. You're just suddenly like overcome with this memory of like you being there, and you can't really put your finger as to why it is. It's most likely due to like the place cells just firing again by you being there. And your brain kind of on its subconscious level has picked up on certain stimuli that, it recognized that this was the somewhere I have been before. Yeah, I think that's good enough to kind of build upon for brains. And so before we recorded this episode, we put out a call for people for them to ask us some questions and things that they've been interested in terms of memory and VR. And so I think we
got a lot of questions, and thank you very much for that.
Yeah, we did. And it seems this is why we are recording the episode, is because people, this has been a hot topic, I think, on a lot of people's minds. And so Steve Began, sorry for mispronouncing your name, from Pulse Design Group, asked the question. He says, I'm curious about how we as users will remember VR experiences. Will it be closer to real life memories compared to moments from films or video games?
From my perspective and what we've presented in this episode already, I am absolutely sure that VR experiences are going to be remembered as closer to real life than videos or films or video games. And that is for the reason that there is just so much more input in the VR games, and then you are so much more in the first person perspective when you're playing them. So on the one hand, where we have much more input, I will remember the event much better than just a film that I'm watching, because I can act on the information that happened in virtual reality. And on the other hand, since in virtual reality, in most of the experiences, I am in the first person perspective, this is coherent with my daily life, where I'm also experiencing my daily life from the first person perspective. And so combining the fact that I can interact with information and the fact that I am participating in the experience from the first-person perspective, and not just first-person perspective like in shooters or RPG games, in video games, but actually being surrounded by the environment and by the whole action. This is just much closer to my real life, and I personally don't see how it can be not remembered much closer to the real life than
I think presence
the previous medium
is a huge factor in this, and you feeling present in whatever experience that you're involved in, I think really changes how closely you associate that memory as being part of your life.
But the games or the experiences that are currently out there are maybe not so memorizable as a movie, because storytelling is yet not such a dominant player in them. It's more about, yeah, I see my hands, I can climb, you know, I can shoot bow, which is great. I'm not sure if this is really memorizable, but the moment those experiences will push you more towards actually feeling something, and I want here to explicitly say that the Guardian VR experiences, so 6x9 that shows you the solitary confinement conditions, is super memorizable. I had a chance to show it to 80 young journalists where I was giving a talk about VR and journalism per se, and VR can induce feelings, empathy, and other things in us that nothing so far can do that easy, because we are already so used to the media over-promising things or over-presenting things and all this buzzing around us, that those 7 minutes you sit down and you actually look around and from time to time you hear something are way more effective to make you feel something, make feel the empathy, and that will definitely increase the memory consolidation. So it is really dependent on the VR experiences, but all in all, if the experience or the game or whatever you call it is actually really good and really well produced, then it will definitely have a higher impact than any documentary or movie or game you ever played.
We have such an inclination of reliving stories. I mean, that's why they're so compelling, right? We know every actor in a movie is just acting, but we're literally inclined to relive what they're living, you know, through our mirror neurons, let's say, of refeeling the emotions that they're feeling. And so once storytelling becomes a much, much more, let's say, enhanced experience in VR, because I think we still don't really know what to do with it yet. Suddenly those memories will be really, really significant. So I'm really interested in seeing that. Daniel Allen from Block Interval, he also talks about experiences, and he says my memories of VR experiences are much more clear than my memories of other types of games. And except that someone, Patrick Mullen, says that his VR experiences are less clear than other games. But I've seen, I think, more on Daniel Allen's side, where they're saying that their experience with VR is like very lucid. How do we explain this, or how do we explain the differences?
I can explain it very easily. It's very easy. I mean, so far a lot of companies, a lot of game publishers are using the wow effect instead of, you know, actually using the full potential of VR. And this is not, you know, I'm not saying they're doing it bad. We all have to figure out how to use VR right now, and the wow effect is just the easiest one, and then you can experiment a little bit more on top. So when you already tried a few of the VR experiences, you know, you're kind of, well, yeah, it's fine. I can move some balls around. I can shoot. I don't remember it so much. So for me, for example, as someone who is reading about VR every day and tried some things and have to develop things, and whenever you develop, you know, things just don't get well and you have to, you know, feel a little bit bad and stuff, it's hard to make me try VR. So it's hard for someone to convince me to try their VR game. They really have to be, you know, something really special, like the Guardian thing I tried, right? So for me, you know, I don't remember really those things. And okay, this hedgehog thingy from Oculus is nice, but you know, Lucky's Tale, well, you can run around, it's a fun game. Yeah, I played it a little, but why would I remember it? It's like a platformer as anything else. So I think it's very subjective towards what you tried and how you tried. Because once again, if you have a Google Cardboard and you try something with that, it's not comparable to, you know, room scaled wife experience or Oculus with a touch controllers, right? So, you know, people have different hardware, different gear. Sometimes their phone is very slow and they still try it with a Google Cardboard or any other cardboards out there. And then their experience might be highly biased.
And I think even expectations going into the experience kind of change the way you'll remember it. So there's a lot of factors, I think. Mike Le Sauvage from Geek Dad asked, when using VR for training, say to learn procedures, is there likely to be significant negative training from the difference in muscle memory? Well, what do you say
from
about
my
that?
From my perspective, I think right now, with the current status of the hardware that we have, this might be actually true. And that is for the reason that, for example, with Vive, at the moment we are tracking just the hands and not even the fingers, just the palms, so to say, the position of the palms, which means that your elbow is not tracked, which means that your knee is not tracked, which means that your foot is not tracked. And that means that you cannot do the full body muscle motion, or you cannot track it with the current VR technology that is for consumers, which means that in the end, you are not learning your, the game is not forcing you to learn the exact movement that you need to do in the real life, but the optimal movement that your hands have to do so that you avoid a certain attack. So to give an example here, there is a game called Hollow Point, in which you are standing in the middle of the dojo, and then you're shooting with the bow at the cubes and ninjas that are attacking you. And the cubes are shooting at your back when you destroy them. But they are shooting at your head position, and you don't have a body. So the most optimal movement that you can do there is just bend your head in the last moment, which for the real life situation is completely pointless, because you would be shot in your knee and your stomach or some other place on your body. So all in all, you can have positive training effect under the condition that you have the right hardware and the right sensor.
And I think if you are, you know, creating a system for training, it's probably geared towards enterprise, and that means there's a lot more money involved. And so, you know, doing, you know, an expensive mocap system, I think, with a lot more points of tracking could definitely, will definitely help you in gaining a more accurate procedural memory of doing things. But I think for the most part, using VR for training is huge. And even if, let's say, there are differences in the actual procedure itself, in procedure in terms of your muscles moving, I think even the slight bit of differences will in the end help you gain a more comprehensive understanding of what that motion is.
So what you actually learn in virtual reality is the explicit memory that changes into reflexes in the sense of the sequence of the things that you need to do. So you could, for example, learn how to dismantle and assemble back a gun in virtual reality. It would not teach you the exact motion that you need to do, but it would teach you that you need to remove parts in a certain order. And then in a real life, you just need to learn the muscle memory.
And, you know, I think just like how YouTube is such a huge resource for us to learn from now, I think VR and AR, absolutely, there's going to be a lot of user-generated content of teaching how to do things and you learning to how to do those things just by seeing it happening in front of you and you repeating the procedure. I'm really, really excited for that platform to start becoming a thing. I don't know how that's going to look and how it'll function, but I think potential for it is absolutely there, and someone will be tapping into it pretty soon, I'm hoping.
I hope it would be a multiple someone's.
Yeah, I think so too. I think a lot of people are looking at UGC, and because right now that doesn't really exist for VR yet. It's all, you know, developer-generated content. And for anything to kind of take off the same way that YouTube and you know, every part of the internet did, you need user-generated content to really drive it forward. Because, like, honestly, users in the end are more creative with coming up with content than a certain set of developers. You just have a wider pool. Daniel Allen is also was talking about him being a visual learner and how that kind of changing the different ways of like he learned. I have a quick note to kind of add on that, and it's that there really isn't much research or any research that supports learning styles, let's say, you know, visual or auditory or hands-on. I think we all benefit from all types of learning, and obviously there are certain individual differences between, you know, what you're paying attention to, what you understand more, what you have more experience with in terms of the things you're learning. But there
It's a subjective part in it. I mean, if you believe that you're learning most through auditory or through, you know, your visual system, then focus on what you believe is mostly working for you, because in order to learn something, you have to be motivated, and you can't be motivated if you force yourself to do something you don't like. And I mean, even though there is no, you know, scientific difference in terms of how you learn, on the other hand, there is a strongly difference how you approach learning. And if you do it in a way that, you know, fun for you, then you should, you know, really enjoy it. And then it should be also working better. So whatever helps.
And finally, Pat Cat. I wish I knew your real name, Pat. He asks, I'd actually be interested to know whether constantly changing VR worlds can affect a user's short-term memory. So for example, does being in an environment that changes frequently, it doesn't act like reality, affect short-term memory, either improve it or
depends.
Not?
There is actually science studies showing that the constant usage of social media and the web, which is primed to short, quick messages, is showing a different structure in the brain in the fMRI. So your short-term memory is more active than your long-term memory, and also more structured and more developed. So you're basically getting primed. And there are also at least claims that there are so many people not being able to pass certain studies those days. For example, the Jura study, so when you want to become a lawyer, because you have to read very long texts and focus on it, and your brain is kind of primed to those quick ICQ messaging, WhatsApp messages, and all the time popping around with, you know, stuff on your computer. And VR might have an influence on that too. However, we are speaking here about people, you know, spending 1 hour of their day in VR, and that won't have any strong influence
on your
memory.
I'm not sure. If you are regularly enough using a certain medium, in this case, virtual reality, and this medium requires you a certain optimal behavior, then this may transfer to other situations.
Sure, but not with adult people. I mean, the neuroplasticity is not so developed. I mean, I would worry more about, you know, very young children, you know, maybe 2 to 10 years being exposed to too much VR. That might have some effects we don't understand. But
I would not underestimate the power of humans to degradate.
Okay.
It's much easier to get lazy and much less efficient than actually correct your behavior and get better.
Oh, yeah. I was watching yesterday, actually, Idiocracy. And yeah, maybe you're right.
Idiocracy? Yeah, that's almost scary of a thing. I don't think we're ever going to go back in terms of going to longer form of content. I think it makes no business sense. Like, there's no reason for products to change the way they're working now and not to essentially work off this, you know, instant gratification and dopamine systems that we have. Because you can just deliver so much more content in a short form to a person and seeing which one is going to stick. And for us, like, it's a very, it's a compelling it's a very compelling experience to come back to that. That's why Twitter is good. That's why Instagram is good. And because you like the scroll, you like the novelty of seeing new posts every whatever, you know, five times a second. And so we're always going to be, I think, down this road. And whether how we can change things, like the, you know, you're talking about the test for lawyers, maybe we just have to start literally writing differently and in shorter form. I think, you know, we've seen
I don't think so.
I think, I mean, look at journalism and see how that's changed. I think there'll always be the long reads, but like, that's a lot less interesting these days.
Let's say it's a different debate, because you could say that because there is so much clickbait out there, people's general perception of the world decreases, and we should actually, you know, make sure that people read better journalism and it is longer and stuff.
Let's come back to the memory in this case. Yeah. So just look at the influence of Wikipedia and having internet in your phone. Even I am retaining or encoding and retrieving much less information right now, because I'm not forced to have those information, because at any time I just pull out my phone, Google how many people live in Germany, and I know it instantly and very precisely, and I don't have to worry that I will remember it wrong, which means that in the modern world where you have a pocket computer, you are relying on the external memory, which means that virtual reality may either be shaped for a short-term memory, or actually support the system when you are just relying on the external memory, in a sense.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said in terms of our attention. And I think in the end, it's harder to change the wave of where things are going rather than to adapt your system to it.
Well, I'm pretty sure that people today who are our dear listeners learned a lot about memory, how it affects in a way, how VR affects memory consolidation and other effects, how you could trigger certain things in VR to be more memorizable or even less memorizable. And there is also a lot of topics we didn't manage to speak about. So we have a lot of links that you can see in our show notes with papers and further material if you're really interested in. As usual, you can ask us questions. We can answer them either directly via email or actually address during the next episode. But yes.
You can find us on the Twitter, or you can even find us on the VR Creators Network, which is a Slack network. And that's where we got a lot of these questions from.
Don't forget to upvote us on iTunes and also Product Hunt.
That's right. Or even just, you know, subscribe to us. And or if you don't want to listen to us on your phone or your podcast app, we also upload everything into SoundCloud as well. That's more for like the desktop experience.
Exactly. And we write articles on Medium. So accept our extensive show notes that you can just read on if you don't have the time to listen to every detail and just want to get a broad overview. You can also check our Medium publication.
That's right. We haven't been written much lately, but in between episodes, if we have thoughts and things that we've noticed, we like to put it on the Research VR publication on Medium. Special thanks for Nerses Balabanian for the intro and outro music. You can find him at soundcloud.com/Nerses-Balabanian. Thanks for everyone for tuning into another episode. See you next time.
Good night.
Housekeeping, that's a new section in the end of the episode where we want to tell you what happened in our lives in terms of VR if you are interested in. That's why it's in the end. If you don't like it, just skip it. Well, that's how it is, right? I mean, maybe you're just interested in the topic, but maybe you also want to get a more personal touch.
Everyone likes to hear about us. Wants to know what's happening in our lives.
A little gossip.
Exactly. Now, Chris and me have been on the CeBIT 2016 and Hannover Messe 2016, the biggest fair of technology.
What's it called again?
CeBIT.
Oh, CeBIT, okay.
CeBIT, yeah, the biggest fair in the world regards new technologies, actually. Innovative technology, yeah, since 25 years in Hannover, I think. In Germany, and the biggest industry fair in the world. The Hannover Messe is surprisingly also in Germany. With the whole industry there. We have been visiting there a lot of people, distributed a lot of, you know, small business cards with Research VR written on them. So if any of our listeners is coming from that fair, hello and welcome once again. But Azad have been quite successful too, and maybe a little bit more successful than VR. Tell us your amazing news.
Well, last week actually was speaking at the non-gaming VR meetup that was hosted at Upload. And I gave a little talk, it was like 5 to 10 minutes long, about using VR in research for VR. I talked a little bit about the research that was done at UCSC and what Research VR is, and we gained a lot of interest through there. So hello to everyone that's tuning in from Upload. So, and I guess in the last month, I've actually started working at Upload VR.
Oh, you guess? Are you sure?
I guess, yes, because I wasn't sure in the beginning. I wasn't sure if it's a real thing or not. So I didn't.
But really, that's a good guess.
I'd say it's a good guess, too.
Yeah.
I'm working as the PM at the Upload Collective, which is the co-working space that Upload opened up in San Francisco. So it's a VR, AR, immersive tech-focused co-working space with a little bit of elements from incubators and whatnot in there.
You should also mention the article you wrote at Upload VR that we will link and people should read it. It's quite good.
I've been doing a little bit of patent trolling. Yeah. Not trolling in the sense of like suing people, but like trolling through patents and reading them and finding interesting things there. So earlier today, I was reading the Magic Leap stuff, which is
Magic Leap is so secretive.
Well, they're secretive, but their patents reveal a lot, actually. Sure. And their display technology is ridiculous. They're doing like light beam, like splicing, like cutting through, essentially having small little mirrors within a display that are reflecting to your eye, but at different angles. And
yeah, but that technology was already used by Glyph. I mean, you remember?
Well, no. That's retinal. So that's retinal projection, and that's coming from the side. This is they're doing something even more interesting with literally like micro arrays of mirrors within a display.
Let's see. Let's see what the future will bring. I guarantee that after consuming $1.3 trillion or how much it was, they will just come up with the next Google Cardboard clone.
Well, speaking of Google Cardboard, Google I.O. is happening.
Yeah.
And I think next week or a week from now. So Android VR will be announced there. And
let's see.
Maybe you're going there as a research VR.
To I.O.?
Yes.
That would be really interesting.
Maybe you can meet Azad there.
Worked out with Upload.
Yeah. By the way, if you want to listen to me giving a talk, I will be in 27th of... What month do we have now?
May.
27th of May, I will be in Göttingen on the VR meetup there. It will be, I think, the second one, and I will give there a short talk. And also, there will be an Industry 4.0 conference from Salt and Pepper, where I work at, where I will also talk about VR. Yay!
What does Industry 4.0 mean?
You put sensors into machines and measure and do predictive maintenance. It's like cloud and any other buzzword.
And machine learning. Integrated.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, I think that's enough for housekeeping. People are caught up with our lives. We'd like to hear more about your lives and send us a message and send us a tweet.
We are lonely.
Tell us how you're feeling. Tell us what you think VR and how VR has helped you shape your life.
You always listen to us, but you never write back. How dare you? Goodbye.
Goodbye. Bye,